publication of the Rotary Club called The Rotarian once told this story about an organization offering a bounty of $5,000 for wolves captured alive. And this turned Sam and Jed into bounty hunters, fortune hunters. Day and night they scoured the mountains and the forests looking for valuable prey. And exhausted one night, they fell asleep dreaming of their potential fortune. And suddenly, Sam awoke in the middle of the night to see that they were surrounded by 50 wolves with gleaming eyes and bared teeth. And he nudged his friend next to him and he said, "Jed, wake up! We're rich!" Well, attitude is crucial to problem solving. But what is attitude? Attitude has been defined as one's mental posture towards a problem or a situation, one's feelings or emotions toward the problem, or the angle or positions of one's frame of reference. Author Tim Hansel has said, "The choice is not if you'll accept problems, but how." Chuck Swindoll has said, "Words can never adequately convey the incredible impact of our attitude toward life. The longer I live," he says, "the more convinced I become that life is 10% what happens to you and 90% how you respond to it." Philosopher William James once wrote, "Perhaps the greatest discovery of this century," he was talking about the 19th century, "is that if you can change your attitude, you can change your life." And author Bruce Bauman agreed with that. He said, "The mind can convince a competent person that he is incompetent, or an adequate person that he is highly talented. Unfortunately, self-doubt and negative attitudes seem to have a more powerful influence on the mind than positive attitudes. Usually a person is not even aware that he is setting himself up or limiting his capabilities." Now, the Bible gives us many examples of attitudes that hinder problem solving, as well as attitudes that advance us over the hurdles of life. And this morning I'd like to take a look at the life of one man who had an incredibly positive attitude when it came to problem solving. And his name is Caleb. And Caleb had what I would call a God-confident attitude. Now, who is Caleb? I know over the 8 years I've been here, we haven't spent a lot of time in the Old Testament. So you may have forgotten who Caleb is. Well, he lived around 1500 B.C. He was a descendant of the Israelite tribe of Judah, as Jesus was after him. He was a contemporary of Moses' successor, Joshua. He was a leader among the Israelites who came out of slavery in Egypt and made their way through the desert to the promised land of Palestine. He was one of the 12 spies sent to analyze the promised land in preparation for taking it over. And he expressed a God-confident attitude when, after checking out the promised land, he said, "We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." Bible commentator F.B. Meyer once described Caleb in this way. He said, "Amid the marchings and the countermarchings, the innumerable deaths, the murmurings and rebellions of the people, he retained a steadfast purpose to do only God's will, to please him, to know no other leader, and to heed no other voice. It was of no use to try and involve that stout lion's cub in any movement against Moses and Aaron. He would be no party to Miriam's jealous spite. He would not be allured by the wiles of the girls of Moab. Always strong and true and pure and noble, like a rock in a changeful sea, like a snow-capped peak in a change of cloud and storm and sun. A man in whose strong nature weaker men could hide, and one who must have been a tower of strength to that new and young generation which grew up to fill the vacant places in the van of Israel. The Nestor of the Hebrew camp. In him the words of the psalmist were anticipated, that he bore fruit in his old age and to the last was fat and flourishing. In short, I think Caleb was the sort of man who would have gone after Moby Dick in a rowboat with a harpoon and a jar of tartar sauce. Now what we need to realize is that Caleb's positive attitude and his positive report about the promised land, these things were prompted by faith, a gift from God. Paul writes in Ephesians and says, "For it is by grace that you have been saved through faith, and this not from yourselves, it is the gift of God." What is faith? Elton Trueblood once said that faith is not belief without proof, but trust without reservation. Caleb, he didn't have a blind faith in God. He had seen God at work in concrete situations in life. He had seen God bring the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt. He had seen God lead His people through the Red Sea on dry ground. He had seen God destroy the Egyptian army when they tried to do the same thing. Caleb's faith in God was based on the evidence of God's prior working in his life and in the life of others. He knew that God was more than a match for the giants of Palestine. He was not merely a self-confident man. He knew that he did not have the resources himself to conquer the giants in the land of Canaan. I think he would have agreed with 19th century orphanage founder George Mueller when he wrote, "Faith does not operate in the realm of the possible. Faith begins where man's power ends." You probably heard the story of the famous tightrope walker who strung a cable across Niagara Falls. And to the applause of thousands, he would walk across that tightrope right on the edge of the falls. He would even do it blindfold. Or he'd ride a bicycle back and forth. And then he'd push a wheelbarrow across the falls on that tightrope. Well, one day while he was getting ready to push the wheelbarrow across the cable strung over the falls, the tightrope walker, he asked the crowd whether they believed that he could successfully push the wheelbarrow across the falls with a person riding in a wheelbarrow. And they expressed absolute confidence in the tightrope walker's ability to accomplish such a feat. But then when he asked for volunteers, suddenly the crowd grew silent. No takers. Well, Caleb had the kind of faith that would get into the wheelbarrow, trusting God to get him across to the other side. The question is, do we have that kind of faith? A.W. Tozer once said, "The man of pseudo-faith will fight for his verbal creed, but refuse flatly to allow himself to get into a predicament where his future must depend upon that creed being true. He always provides himself with secondary ways of escape so that he will have a way out if the roof caves in." What we need very badly these days, Tozer says, is a company of Christians who are prepared to trust God as completely now as they know they must do at the last day. Caleb was that kind of man. He was a man of real faith. And he was blessed by God because he followed God wholeheartedly. In Numbers 14:24, we read of God's promise to Caleb. "But because my servant Caleb has a different spirit and follows me wholeheartedly, I will bring him into the land he went to, and his descendants will inherit it." And that word, wholeheartedly, is used to describe Caleb six times in the Bible. In other words, Caleb had quite a faith in God. He gave himself to God. As I said before, being a Christian means giving as much as you know of yourself to as much as you know of God. Caleb was a fearless man because he trusted wholeheartedly in the Lord to take care of him. As 19th century novelist George MacDonald once wrote, he said, "It is man's business to do the will of God. God takes on himself the special care of that man. Therefore, that man ought never to be afraid of anything." One of the things I find most inspiring about the life of Caleb is that he followed the Lord his whole life. And it was a long life. After entering the promised land at age 85, Caleb asked Joshua for the hill country of Hebron. And he drove the giants out of there. Here's what we read in Joshua chapter 14. "Now then, just as the Lord promised," these are the words of Caleb, "He has kept me alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses, while Israel moved about in the desert. So here I am today, 85 years old. I am still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. Now give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourself heard then that the Anakites were there and their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helping me, I will drive them out just as he said." And then later on in Joshua chapter 15, we read about the fulfillment of what Caleb asked for. "Then Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and gave him Hebron as his inheritance. So Hebron has belonged to Caleb, son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, ever since, because he followed the Lord, the God of Israel," what? "Wholeheartedly." I sure would like to be like Caleb when I'm 85. How about you? Trusting and obeying the Lord with an attitude of confidence in him. It can lead to a long, good life. It probably won't be a life without struggle, for Caleb certainly experienced that in the desert for 40 years. And he had to struggle to conquer the giants. I'm sure it wasn't easy. But at age 85, he was still strong and he was still living by faith. What an example. Caleb, I think, was a go-for-it kind of guy his whole life long. I think he would have agreed with John Bainbridge, who once wrote this. He said, "A man with 50 problems is twice as alive as a man with 25. If you haven't got problems, you should get down on your knees and say, 'Lord, don't you trust me anymore?'" That's a great attitude. What we need to realize is that problems are our greatest opportunity to show the power of God to a watching world. If we realize that, then we'll have a God-confident attitude as we face our problems. In this same story about Israel spying out the promised land, we have examples of two unhealthy attitudes when it comes to handling problems. Caleb and Joshua, they had God-confident attitudes, but the other 10 spies who were with Caleb and Joshua, they had, at least at first, unconfident attitudes. We read about them in Numbers chapter 13. "But the men who had gone up with him said, 'We can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are.' And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, 'The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes.'" What an interesting expression. "And we looked the same to them." How did they know how they looked to them? The 10 spies, they spoke evil of the Lord by spreading a bad report about the land he had provided. And these 10 spies, I think they would have agreed with the man who said, "The pioneers, those are the guys with the arrows in their backs. And these 10 spies, they didn't want to end up with arrows in their backs. They had no confidence that God could enable them to beat the giants in the land. Alan Redpath once said that 10 spies had great giants and a little God. But Caleb and Joshua had a great God and little giants. David said in Psalm 34:3, "Glorify the Lord with me, let us exalt His name together." But the 10 spies, they probably would have had David write something like, "Oh, come, let us magnify our problems together. Let us talk about them until they become impossible." And you know, an unconfident attitude can spread like cancer. We read in Numbers 14:1 what happened after the Israelites received this negative report from the 10 spies. "That night all the people of the community raised their voices and wept aloud." And this kind of unconfident attitude comes, of course, from taking our eyes off the Lord. And that can lead to despair. There was a mother who once told this story. She said, "When my daughter Katie was small, she worried about falling off the changing table, twisting her head so that the end of the table was right in front of her eyes. She would cry, 'I've fallen, Mama, I've fallen.' And when my reassurances would fail, I'd say, 'Don't look at the edge, look at Mama.' And as her focus shifted to my face, she'd become peaceful." And then that mother said, "I too know the temptation to look at the edge when unpredictable or difficult times arise. Again and again, God must remind me, 'Look at me, daughter. Don't look at the edge.' How sweet it is to lift my eyes to meet His faithful and loving gaze and know peace in the midst of turmoil." The good news is that the Lord can and will forgive our lack of confidence in Him. I'm grateful for that, because I've had a lousy attitude this week. I should have been reading this sermon over to myself all week. You know, because we had a little bit of a challenging time this week. I never knew until trying to move to the D.C. area that trying to find a rental property is a competitive sport. You know, we had our application in on a place, and then we found out somebody else's application was taken ahead of ours, even though we got ours in first. That didn't matter. So we had to go up for a third time to look for a place, and we did that on Friday. And so we put our application in on another place, and as we were doing that, we found out the first guy on the first place we wanted dropped out. So now we have a chance. So now we got our application in on two places. But in the midst of those little ups and downs, you know, I've had just frankly a really bad attitude. So I'm glad that God can forgive us when we get our eyes off of Him. In Numbers 14:20, we read God's response to Moses. "The Lord replied, 'I have forgiven them as you asked.'" The people didn't even ask to be forgiven for their bad attitudes. Moses asked that God would forgive them, and God did that. But an unconfident attitude may cause us to miss all sorts of blessings. If we read on through Numbers 14, we see the blessings that the Israelites missed because of their lack of confidence in the Lord. "Nevertheless, as surely as I live, and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of the men who saw my glory and my miraculous signs I performed in Egypt and in the desert, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their forefathers. No one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it." Remember, these same 10 who brought the negative report, they had seen the same miracles that Caleb and Joshua had seen. But for some reason, they were unwilling to act on that knowledge and believe that God could do the same thing and more again. You may have heard the famous story of the shoe salesman who was sent by his company to Africa, into a territory that had been unreached by this particular shoe company in the past. And the eager salesman, he got on the plane and he aggressively went about his work of trying to sell shoes. And 3 weeks later, however, he phoned the president of the company, very frustrated, and he said, "Send me a plane ticket, I'm coming back." "Didn't you realize that the people in this place don't wear shoes? This job is impossible." And so the company, they sent him a return ticket, but some months later they hired a woman who was very excited about the possibilities, and she got to Africa, and 3 weeks later she phoned the company's president. And he was anticipating the same kind of response from her, but was surprised to hear her say, "This place is amazing. The possibilities are endless. What an incredible opportunity. Do you realize these people don't wear shoes? This job is wonderful." Attitude makes all the difference. If we have an attitude of confidence in God, we can face down the giants in the land. If we have no confidence in God, eventually the giants of the land will be too big for us. A second negative attitude that gets us in trouble when it comes to solving problems is a self-confident attitude. And it may seem amazing, but these same Israelites who at one point have an unconfident attitude, then swing over to the other side and they have a self-confident attitude. After Moses told them that God was going to make them wander in the desert for 40 years because of their lack of confidence in Him, here's what happened. When Moses reported this to all the Israelites, they mourned bitterly. Early the next morning, they went up to the high hill country. "We have sinned," they said. "We will go up to the place the Lord promised." But Moses said, "Why are you disobeying the Lord's command? This will not succeed. Do not go up, because the Lord is not with you. You will be defeated by your enemies, for the Amalekites and Canaanites will face you there. Because you have turned away from the Lord, He will not be with you, and you will fall by the sword." Nevertheless, it says, in their presumption, they went up toward the high hill country, though neither Moses nor the Ark of the Lord's Covenant moved from the camp. And then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and attacked them and beat them down all the way to Hormah. In response to God's punishment, the Israelites acted presumptuously. You see, faith is only as good as its object. And the Israelites had a misplaced faith at this point. They were trusting in themselves rather than in God. God hadn't told them to go up right then. They were trusting in what they wanted to do. And it didn't succeed. You know, it's amazing what people put their trust in. Amazing number of people still put their trust in our government, despite many failings. One writer has said this: "The trend of government is to undergird us with material securities from the cradle to the grave, providing all kinds of insurances, health, old age, education, unemployment, and so on. In addition, we insure ourselves against fire and earthquake and hurricane and accident and old age. These safeguards are not wrong, but they can very easily become a serious hindrance to our complete trust in God. Undoubtedly, if our debts are paid and our refrigerator full, if we have money in the bank, we have a tendency to feel secure in ourselves and to sense our need of God less. Herein lies the danger. My greatest need is to feel and know my need of God every hour." We have the habit of trusting in anything and everything but God. In fact, we put most of our trust in ourselves. But it's impossible to conquer certain problems when we remained self-confident. In his book, Waiting, Finding Hope Where God Seems Silent, a friend of our family, Ben Patterson, tells this story. And he says, in the summer of 1988, three friends and I climbed Mount Lyell, the highest peak in the Yosemite National Park. Two of us were experienced mountaineers. Two of us were not. I was not one of the experienced ones. The climb to the top and back was to take the better part of a day, due in large part to the difficulty of the glacier that one must cross to get to the top. And as the hours passed and as we trudged up the glacier, the two mountaineers opened up a wide gap between me and my less experienced companion. And being competitive by nature, I began to look for shortcuts that I might be able to take to beat them to the top. And I thought I saw one to the right of an outcropping of rock. So I went up, deaf to the protests of my companions. 30 minutes later, I was trapped in a cul-de-sac of rock atop the Lyell Glacier, looking down several hundred feet of a sheer slope of ice, pitched at a 45-degree angle. I was only 10 feet from the safety of a rock. But one little slip, and I wouldn't stop sliding until I had landed in the valley floor about 50 miles away. I was stuck, and I was scared. It took an hour for my experienced climbing friends to find me. Standing on the rock I wanted to reach, one of them leaned out and used an ice axe to chip two little footsteps in the glacier. And then he gave me the following instructions. Ben, you must step out from where you are and put your foot where the first foothold is. Without a moment's hesitation, swing your other foot across and land it in the next step. Then reach out and I will take your hand and I will pull you to safety. But listen carefully. As you step across, don't lean into the mountain. If anything, lean out a bit. Otherwise, your feet could fly out from under you and you will start sliding down. And Ben says, when I'm on the edge of a cliff, my instinct is to lie down and to hug the mountain, to become one with it, not to lean away from it. But that was what my good friend was telling me to do as I stood trembling on that glacier. I looked at him real hard. And for a moment, based solely on what I believed to be true about the goodwill and the good sense of my friend, I decided to say no to what I felt, to lean out, to step out and traverse the ice to safety. It took less than 2 seconds to find out if my faith was well-founded. It was. And so often in life, we put the wrong kind of confidence in ourselves, and we end up in a cul-de-sac at the top of a slippery slope. And the only way out is to put our trust back in the right place, to put our trust back in God through Jesus Christ, to lean out from the mountain and take a step of faith toward Him. We need to ask God to give us that God-confident attitude for solving problems. Jesus never ran away from His problems. He met them head on. Jesus didn't even run away from the cross. That's what I would have done. But He didn't. He went to the cross to die for self-confident and unconfident people like us. And He can give us His mind and His heart to face problems with a God-confident attitude, if we'll let Him. I've shared this, I think, a few times with you before. One of my favorite quotes of all time. Many years ago, King George VI of England addressed the British Commonwealth in his Christmas broadcast. at a moment in history when the whole world stood on the brink of uncertainty, as they had just stepped into World War II. Despondency filled the air as he spoke these memorable words of someone else, a poet. "I said to the man at the gate of the year, 'Give me a light that I may walk safely into the unknown.' And he said to me, 'Go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. It shall be to you safer than the light and better than the known way.'" Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the wonderful example of Caleb. An example we only have because of the faith that you gave to him. The faith that you enabled him to exercise. Not just at one critical moment, but through a lifetime. Father, I thank you that that faith is a gift. Because if it was dependent on me, I know I don't have it. But I ask you to give me that gift. I ask you to give that gift to my friends gathered here today. That we might step out into the unknown and put our hand into your hand. Even amidst the darkness, trusting that you will be to us better than a light and safer than a known way. For we ask it in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen.